We are in Matthew chapter 26. We just got done with Judas going and striking a deal. A deal for 30 silver coins, that's all. So that he can hand over Jesus. I made a suggestion at the end of last class that as we will see it develop, I'm not totally convinced that in the Gospel of Matthew, that Judas was intentionally trying to be evil, but maybe was just functioning under the wrong lens. However, hold on, what's going on? Hello. However, even though he's functioning under the wrong lens, that is still an indictment. That is still something that is not positive, because if he's functioning under the lens that Jesus has been trying for the past 3 years to establish, or function under a different lens than what Jesus is trying to establish, then he is functioning under a lens that Satan was perpetuating in Matthew chapter 4, and that the Jews were perpetuating all throughout Jesus' ministry. So it's not that he is innocent of anything. Are you hearing me in that very clearly? It's just that my question is, historically speaking, in the Gospel of Matthew, what is his motivation? And the Gospel of Matthew doesn't seem to suggest that it is because he is in league with Satan doing seances or anything weird like that. You see what I mean? I'm asking from Matthew's perspective, what is the motivation? And it doesn't seem to be that he just wants to be a mafia guy and lop off Jesus. Instead, Judas might be functioning under the wrong lens, which is still something that's a problem. So hear me very clearly. I'm not trying to excuse what Judas did. I'm trying to understand from the Gospel of Matthew what he did. You see the difference? So I'm not arguing that Judas will be in heaven. Because I think, John calls him a son of hell. So I think we're on the same page there. Or Jesus will say in a minute that it'd be better for him never to have been born. So I'm not saying he gets off scot-free or anything like that. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions about yesterday before we move on? Yes, David.
Do we know how much worth was the 30 pieces of silver, in that time, were they?
I'll be honest, off the top of my head, I don't. Somebody may be able to help out with that, but it wasn't much. It wasn't a lot. Yeah.
That was the price that you bought a slave for?
Yeah, see, there's speculation about that. We don't have that evidence solid. We also have evidence that that'd be something that you'd even also buy some cattle for. But it's nothing solid. I'll be honest with you, the only remote parallel that we have, I think, is from Zechariah. I don't have it in my notes, but I think it's from Zechariah. But even the parallel in the Old Testament of a 30 silver coins is pretty loose at best. So there's really not solid, I don't feel like there's solid connections. Yeah?
Don't we have an axe that takes the money and buy a field with it?
Well, yeah, that'll actually happen here in chapter 27. But at least they buy a plot of land. But even still, the plot of land that is bought is a potter's field. It's pretty much condemned land. So I mean, you'd be able to get it for dirt cheap. It's not like today where an acre costs several thousand dollars. Don't think economic buying of land in that way. A potter's field was good for nothing. That's why they decided just to bury people there, and they were burying sinners. It was a dirty field. Bought from a dirty person, an unclean person with unclean money. It's worthless. Absolute worthless. That's why they would just bury people there. So it's not much. But frankly, all the connections that people have tried to make, I've not been overwhelmingly convinced about any of them. That's why I didn't even put it in the notes. So, good questions though. Yeah. Anything else about yesterday? All right, let's move on. Verse 17, chapter 26. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, this would have been Thursday afternoon, because the Passover meal would be eaten Thursday evening after sundown. And we'll talk about the whole sundown, sunup thing by and by, especially whenever it comes to Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection and things about that. But right now, at verse 17, we are in Thursday afternoon. Jesus will be crucified on Friday. He will resurrect on Sunday. Okay? So that's where we're at right now in the whole progression of this. The disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to go make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" Like I said, traditional meal on Thursday night after sundown. He replied, "Go into the city to a certain man and tell him, 'The teacher says, my appointed time is near. I'm going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples at your house.' So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them and prepared the Passover. What does that sound like? What does that sound familiar? What's that?
The triumphal entry.
Yeah, the triumphal entry, doesn't it? Where he's like, hey, go find so-and-so, and literally that's kind of what it even says, and tell so-and-so that that donkey is going to be reserved for the Lord. And if anybody gives you any problems, just remind them. The appointed time is near, and it's time to take the donkey. And honestly, why the ambiguity? Why? I mean, is this supernatural? Is this Jesus has, set up the things before this time? Or is it Jesus just using authority language? We don't really know. We don't really know. However, in a minute, I'm going to suggest that the reason why that does remind us of the triumphal entry, reason why some of the language and the ambiguity points back to the triumphal entry, is because I think he's taking us back to the context of Zechariah 9 again. And we'll get to that in a minute, because in a moment he's about ready to say something that is clearly in Zechariah. So just keep that in the back of your mind as we keep going. Verse 20. When evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12. And while they were eating, he said, I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me. I mean, my word, leave it to Jesus to just, kind of get the conversation rolling, Hey guys, we're eating, one of you is going to betray me. And everybody's like, what? Let's get a little lighter. This isn't the first time he's done that, though, has it? This isn't like this is the very first time he's breached this conversation, is it? No? Where does anybody remember? Where else? Cheat if you must. Anywhere? Anyone? Give you a hint. One was 6 chapters ago, and one was 9 chapters ago. You guys are all... Jeremy's back there doing the math. See, 6 minus 7. Okay. Anything? No? No? Chapter 17? After the what? What's in chapter 17?
Transfiguration.
Transfiguration. They're coming down the mountain, and what does Jesus say in verse 22? Son of Man's going to be betrayed. Then we go in chapter 20. What's going on in chapter 20? Cheat. Look in chapter 20. Yes, exactly. And once again, the concept of betrayal is there. The handing over. Okay, let's keep going on. I'm asking you these questions up front because it seems like a lot of you are having a hard time to stay awake, so I'm going to keep asking questions just so that we're all, here together. We only have like 5 classes together, so let's cherish them, okay? Anyway, okay. They were very sad, naturally, and began to say to him one after the other, surely not I, Lord. Surely not I. One after another, surely not I. Although, keep that phrasing in mind. Surely not I, Lord. Jesus replied, the one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to the man that betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born. That is the only statement in Matthew, that makes me think, yeah, Judas still is going to get his. In Matthew, it'd be better if he was not even born. Because everywhere else in Matthew, it seems to be painted a different picture. But that one phrase by itself makes me think, no, Judas in Matthew did not get off scot-free. Does that make sense? We have to take all the evidence into account. Then Judas, the one who would betray him, said, surely not I, Rabbi. What do you notice? Yeah, that's weird. As a matter of fact, what does Rabbi kind of sound like or remind you of? Another word that's used a lot, especially in after the triumphal entry. What does that sound like? What?
Teacher.
Surely not I, teacher. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Teacher, who should pay taxes to Caesar? Should we? Teacher, at the resurrection, who will this one be married to? What does that sound like? Yeah. Outsiders speaking. Yeah. See, I think there's a little hint here. I was talking with Mark Moore about it, and he said, well, the question you have to ask is this Mark's relay or Matthew's relaying of the situation, or did Judas really say that? Answer is, I don't know. Bottom line is, Matthew does give us a little hint. He does give us a little hint. Judas is speaking in this moment to Jesus as an outsider. Surely not I, Rabbi. And he's going to say that again in just a minute. He'll kiss him on the cheek in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he says, greetings, Rabbi. Big difference. I don't think that the word shift from Lord to Rabbi is on accident here in chapter 26. Surely not I, Rabbi. And Jesus answered, yes, it is you. This conversation is probably happening, though, on a side because the disciples, whenever Judas comes in Garden of Gethsemane, still seem shocked. Still seem shocked. But this is the very first time, well, this and the passages came right before it, where Judas agrees to betray Jesus, that we are seeing Judas in the light of betraying Jesus. Even in 10:2, we talked about this yesterday, how whenever it says Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus, the word handed him over doesn't necessarily have to carry a negative connotation. So Judas is starting to be revealed as the adversary, even though that may not be his overall motivation. While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it, take and eat. This is my body." Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and offered it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." And this is very interesting. First of all, let me finish this. Verse 29. Then I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. Let me just get on a little bit of a Lord's Supper soapbox here just for a second. Man, we've messed up the Lord's Supper so bad in our movement. It is just, it's an atrocity, if I'm being flat out honest. It is a mess. Can I just say this without getting crucified? It blows my mind how hard we fight for the mode of baptism, but we don't really care about the mode of Lord's Supper. It's weird to me. That's really weird. I mean, I know people that literally, if somebody is on their deathbed and they want to give their life to Jesus and they want to be baptized, but if they're submerged, they literally will die instantly. And they say, will you at least, like, you know, sprinkle me with water? Absolutely not, because that's not the right mode of baptism. And yet, it's the same person that will administer the Lord's Supper with a bunch of little chiclets and shot glasses on Sunday morning. Like, can we just be selective about what we want to be passionate about? About what we're going to divide people over? If you're going to divide people, you might as well be consistent all the way across the board and just divide them on every mode of everything. Right? As a matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians, Paul makes it pretty clear that the mode of the Lord's Supper, pretty important. Why is there one loaf at the Lord's Supper? Why is there one piece of bread? Body. We are one body. What are we saying by all the little individual chiclets? What are we saying? Symbolically, it seems to be emphasizing individualism, doesn't it? But who cares about the mode of the Lord's Supper? It doesn't really matter. We do it every Sunday, Shane. We got to be convenient and efficient. It's easier to have all the little, you know, saltine crackers just chopped up already for us. Besides, OSHA will shut us down. It's just weird to me. It's also weird to me that at the Lord's Supper, what we do is we isolate ourselves into a cognitive moment whenever we try to connect to Jesus just in our minds. And yet the Lord's Supper, all throughout the day, was always a feast. It was always a festival. It was the climax of their meeting together. Always. It was a communal moment whenever you're uniting with the people around you, not only here, but the great cloud of witnesses that have come before you. It was a moment whenever you were uniting with Jesus in a way that is more tangible than any other day in which you walk. Yes, I am saying, I am suggesting, I am affirming that the Lord's Supper, Jesus is more present there than at any other moment. If you've heard of the debates of the transubstantiation and the consubstantiation, the Catholics say that the bread and the juice literally turns into the body and the blood of Jesus. You know, and the Protestants over here say, no, it's just that Jesus is just kind of there at the table with us. And that's the debate. But notice something. We've rejected both sides with the way we do the Lord's Supper today. Because we don't even act like He's there at all. We act like that all we have to do is just to get our minds and just think really hard and make sure that we ask for forgiveness for all of our sins. But in 1 Corinthians, he says, do that before you come to the Lord's Supper. Not while you're there. I believe that Jesus in the Lord's Supper is there in that moment, presently, more present than at any other moment whenever you're walking with him in your Christian life. Because that's actually the debate. Neither one of them was arguing that Jesus wasn't there. They were arguing how he was there. Was he the actual body and blood, or was he just there presently in some form that we can't see? Regardless, the Lord's Supper's intention is to be a unifying thing in which all of us are taking part in the new covenant, the blood of the covenant. It makes much more sense to me to be serving each other the Lord's Supper, to be praying with each other during the Lord's Supper, to be up moving around and loving on each other and crying with each other at the Lord's Supper. That makes sense to me. But this isolated thing, whenever we get rid of all the one bread and get rid of all the one cup and we make it all individualized, is almost becoming to the point where I don't know if I recognize it anymore. It's almost gotten that far away. Where I'm going, what is this? It really just feels like a mid-flow snack. Because we've ripped away all the symbolic key elements of it that makes it what it is. And Jesus says right here that he will once again drink it with us at the second coming. This is a big deal. This is the moment whenever we celebrate the kingdom in the present that we're looking forward to in the future because of what he's done in the past. It is where literally all of time collides in this one moment. All of time. It infuses every moment of history with meaning. And yet, we do with it whatever we want. I'm almost more uncomfortable with the lack of mode of the Lord's Supper than I am the lack of mode with the baptism. I'm getting to the point where it's really bothering me that bad. What are you going to do about your churches? I don't know. But I think it's something we need to reflect on. At least reflect on. Yeah, I saw some hands.
I hear what you're saying. I totally agree. How do you have one loaf and one cup with a congregation of 3,000? Or even at College Heights?
Yeah.
Like, just on the practical side.
Let me say this really quick. Whenever it's staying one loaf, it would make more sense to have 15 one loaves that everybody would grab a piece from and dip it into the cup like they've done for centuries than it would for us to have 3,000 individual little pieces.
Right. Yeah. That's
yeah.
Or maybe you make like a huge loaf and everyone come up to the front or something?
Yeah, it's there are multitudes of ways of doing this creatively. The point is this. If you all are grabbing pieces from one loaf and you're watching it pull away and you all are partaking in something that was at one point whole, that's the point. That's the point. So you hear what I mean in that. Like, you know, there will be questions of practicality and things of that nature. Guess what? If they can make a 5-foot sub, we can do something to deal with the Lord's Supper in a way where it makes sense. You know what I'm saying? Bottom line is that, we can be more creative. We're smart cookies. We're really, you know, we do pretty well. Yeah.
Have you ever, like, actually suggested this in a real church application?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've done it once, but usually a lot of times what they try to turn it into is like a cool thing we do once a month. Like, not the Lord's Supper, because you do that every week. You have to, because the Bible says so, or something like that. But what they do is like, ooh, that was a really cool moment. Let's do that once a month, but we'll do it our other way, you know, the other 3-4 times a week, you know. Which, you know, hey, we're closer. And you just, I mean, it's one of those things where, again, in all these different suggestions, you got to be patient with people, and you can't ramrod it. You can't. You can't force it. You have to let it grow. It has to come through teaching. It has to come through patience. But I do think it's something that we should pay attention to. Again, it just blows my mind that we fight so hard for the mode of baptism, but we just disregard this as if it's not a big deal. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. Doesn't make any sense to me. Because baptism is something that we're united with Jesus in. So is the Lord's Supper. I mean, I don't know how you can put one above the other. That's why they both were considered sacraments back in the day. along with marriage and death rites and other stuff. Yes?
How often should we do communion?
Oh, I mean, I'm down with once a week. I mean, it's cool with me. Whenever the early church got together, you know, they broke bread. I think being legalistic on any side of that spectrum is silly. You know, it's like we come on Wednesday nights, you know, at sometimes at churches back in the day, and like, oh, everybody, people left, and we didn't have the Lord's Supper. Chill out. It's okay. You know, it's not the end of the world. So we'll do it next time, you know. You don't have to be legalistic either way. I think it's silly when people are like, no, we only do it once because once a month or once a quarter because we want to make sure it's special. If your unity with Jesus isn't special because you're unifying with him too much, I have a problem with that. You know, the point is, whatever your community is uniting on, I don't see Jesus saying, if you don't do it this way, you're going to go to hell. So the frequency of it, I don't think you can do it too much. I really don't. I do think you can maybe do it too little. But anyway, yes?
This was on a movie, but they were portraying like the Catholic religion as like they believe that like if a person hadn't taken the Lord's Supper before they died, then they weren't saved. Like that was part of their salvation, sort of.
I don't know if that's a Vatican II thing, legitimately.
I didn't know if that had any merit or if it was just something that they...
It's probably more of a portrayal, or I guess it depends on what time period they're portraying it in, because maybe at one point the Catholic Church maybe did that, but even nowadays, like whenever I go to monasteries, they're not allowed to administer me communion, because I'm not a Catholic, and yet what they say is like, we still consider you a brother in Christ, so come up here and we'll bless you. And so I go up there and they anoint my head with water or whatever, which I like, you know. But you know, those crazy Catholic people. No. Matter of fact, okay, we got a little bit of time. Oh, yeah, thanks, man. Sorry. That was right on the top of my tongue, too. There is... Modernity has done a bad thing for us whenever it convinced us that there was a bigger separation between material world and supernatural world than what there really is. I will say this. I do think there's something supernatural with the emblems. Do I think it turns into his literal body and blood? No. But I do know this. And my evidence for this is going to sound silly, but it is what it is. During the time of the Reformation, there was a major debate that occurred because this one woman was demon-possessed. And neither side was having success of casting out the demon. The Protestants were over here. Well, it started off with the Catholics. The Catholics couldn't cast out the demon. The Protestants came in and said, the reason why you can't cast it out is because you're not the true church. So they come in. They try. They couldn't. Matter of fact, the demon was laughing at them. And finally, the demon looked at him and he said, I will only be able to be cast out by a bishop because that's how powerful I am. Well, the Protestants at that point had a problem. Why? Because they didn't have bishops. So the demon strategically said, no, I'm going to create this division even further. Matter of fact, I think this story right here is the reason why Protestants don't mess with demon possession very much at all, and Catholics still do. Because this was a major black eye for the Protestants. What ends up happening is this girl goes for a bishop. He's trying to cast it out. It won't. Then what he does is he administers to this woman the Lord's Supper. And the moment that the emblems touched her tongue, the demon was cast out. I do think that there are things supernatural about the Lord's Supper. I really do. I do believe that Jesus is present in that moment more than any other time. Yeah, there's just not as big of a separation between the material world and the supernatural world as what we like to make it. We like to make it all appear in the cognitive realm, that's what we're interacting with Jesus on. That's just not true. That's just not true. So that's my evidence on that, even though people will say, that's not true. Well, whatever.
So what do you think about the blood?
What do you mean?
The Catholics, they all drink from one cup.
Yeah.
Have our individuals the same concept?
Here's the thing. It's kind of like asking the question, is it just a symbol or is it not? I don't, you know what I mean? Like the blood and the, I don't know how to answer that. because I don't know what just a symbol is. Because every symbol always, in some sense, we're getting into some symbolic theory here, but this is Revelation stuff, so I like it. It encapsulates some sense of the actual essence of that which it is symbolizing, which is the reason why whenever you do something damaging a symbol, people get so upset. Which is the reason why, for example, somebody says, I hate America, okay. Somebody burns the flag, a little different. Why? Because the symbol is the flag actually America? That question doesn't make sense. Because that's the symbol is bigger than America, and yet it also contains it. So whenever I'm asked, is this just a symbol, or is this actually the blood of Jesus? I'm going, I don't understand the question. Because that's not the way symbols work. For example, maybe this can give you some context for my Catholic friends as well, and my Greek Orthodox friends. Whenever Catholics or Greek Orthodox are kissing like statues of Mary, they're not engaging in idolatry. They think they're actually kissing Mary. And I'm not saying that facetiously. They believe that every picture or every image of a person actually contains part of that person. And there's a sense in which that is actually true. Because if I show you a picture up here of me and my son, it may mean not that much to you. But for me, there's something that ignites in me more than just visual stimulus. More than just visual reality. I am connecting with that picture in a spiritual way as well. It's beyond what the symbol itself can encapsulate. And that to me is also, I play that into the Lord's Supper. When they are kissing like the image of Mary, they don't think that they're kissing an image. They think they're interacting with her. It's a big difference. Now, I think we need to be a little bit more broad-minded to understand exactly what they're doing instead of just saying, you bunch of idolatrous pagans. No. They're not engaging in idolatry. They're kissing their mom. I don't think I'm idolatrous whenever I kiss my mom. You ever met a mom that's lost a son? And she has a picture of him at all times? Or she has maybe like one of his handkerchiefs and she'll smell it. Or she'll kiss it. Is she worshiping him? No. She's engaging with him. She's remembering him. She's loving on him. Why? Because symbols are bigger than just symbols. They don't just point to something, they encapsulate something as well. And the Lord's Supper is just like that. It doesn't just point to Jesus' death. There is a sense in which it is a both-and answer. Is it a symbol to something that it is not? Sure. Is it also something that is bigger than what it is? Yes. Yes. We've spent too much time on that, even though I hope that was beneficial. Okay, let's keep moving. Lord's Supper, where am I at? Verse 30, when they had sung a hymn, they went to the Mount of Olives. What hymn did they sing? Two possible options. Yes, I'm actually going to make a guess on this. It's possible, because we know that they're after Passover, they're singing one of two things. Either a psalm from chapter 113 through 118 of the Psalms, or Psalm 136. Psalm 136 normally was the last psalm that you would sing at Passover. And the reason why you would sing it is because it recounted all the good deeds that God had done in the past. And it utilizes a consistent refrain in Psalm 136. His love endures forever. His love endures forever. And that's how they would end their Passovers, which was very, very appropriate. Because whenever you're in a time of suffering and a time of pain, what you want to be reminded over and over and over is that even in the times of suffering and pain, God's love endures forever. Yes.
What was the first one?
The first one was Psalms 113 through 118. It could have been any of those because those were the consistent Passover Psalms. Psalms of liberation. The last one was Psalm 136. Okay. Then Jesus told them, this very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd. Oh man, I totally missed something up earlier. No, I don't have time. You can ask for my notes later, I'll send them to you. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. Let me say this really quick though. The words blood of the covenant, look those up in the Old Testament. It's only used twice. Very intriguing. Very intriguing. It is only used twice in the Old Testament. It is only used in the New Testament in the context of the Lord's Supper, blood of the covenant. Okay. I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. He is quoting there Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. And what is significant is the context in which this is discussed. Zechariah 13, 8 through 9, so right after verse 7, says this. In the whole land, declares the Lord, two-thirds will be struck down and perish, yet one-third will be left in it. Sounds like a remnant. Whoa, maybe that should influence some of our Israel remnant theology. This third I will bring into the fire. I will refine them like silver and test them like gold. They will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. Identity language. And they will say, the Lord is our God. Identity. So the whole context of Zechariah 13, where he quotes Zechariah 13 verse 7, but verses 8 and 9, it's in the context of a creation of a new people. It's creation of a new people that comes from the destruction of a people. And yet there is a remnant that's preserved that all the world will be blessed through. And that's what he quotes right here. You all will leave me, you will abandon me, but the creation of my people is still progressing. Verse 33, Peter replied, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. Oh, good Peter. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, this very night before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. Oh, poor Peter. But Peter declared, even if I have to die with you, I never will disown you. And all the other disciples said the same. What are they saying right there? Even when we go to war and fight, violence against violence, we will not disown you. Why? Because you're the Messiah and you can do whatever, you will be victorious. What's in their mind? What's in their lens? What are they looking through? Probably the same one that Judas is looking through. They're still looking for a bloody revolution, aren't they? Even after he gets done talking about someone will betray me and hand me over. Even after multiple times he said they will crucify me at the hands of the evil ones. They say, when the bloody revolution starts, I'll be there with my sword strapped on. And Peter makes good on that promise here in just a couple verses. Even though it doesn't say Peter. Ooh, but we know from other passages. Sorry, Peter. Verse 36. I'm not going to apologize for what the topic is of the Garden of Gethsemane. And I need to say that very carefully, or very clearly. Because people will always accuse me, every time I talk about the issue of nonviolence, of pushing an agenda. But I'm telling you, right here in the Garden of Gethsemane, there is no other agenda on the plate except for violence versus nonviolence. Sorry. It's just the way it is. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, sit here while I go over there and pray. He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. First of all, who did he take with him? The inner three. Where have we seen them all three going somewhere before? Transfiguration. Transfiguration in chapter 17, exactly. So the inner three, once again, is going to Jesus, and they're going to see him transfigured, but it's not the magnificence of what they saw in the Mount of Transfiguration. Now they're going to see him transfigured into this sorrowful mess. Because Jesus' humanity is never more clear than in these verses. For he's sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as what I will, but as you will. Cup is used three times in Matthew. What are they? Here? Two other places. We just saw one today. Lord's Supper. Where is the third? Yes. The sons of Zebedee. The mother comes and she says, can my son sit at your right hand and your left hand whenever you go into glory? And he says, do you think you can really drink the cup that I'm about to drink? Oh yeah, we can drink it. He says, oh, you will drink it. But not now. The ones that, you know, the people that are my right and my left, I can't grant that. Only God can. Cup is always used in the context of suffering. Cup is always used in the context of sufferings. And Jesus asks, can this cup be taken from me? Then he returned to the disciples and found them sleeping. Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? He asked Peter. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation, where does that throw you back to? That one word, where does that throw me back to? Chapter 4. For the same thing that Jesus was being tempted in chapter 4 by Satan is also being tempted here in the Garden of Gethsemane. I think the Passover or the Passion of the Christ got it right, where Satan is whispering to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Absolutely. Because even Jesus here, he will go 3 different times to pray. And every time he will overcome by submitting his allegiance to God alone. How many times was he tempted in the wilderness? 3. In the temptation, the issue is exactly the same. Be a different king. Be a different kingdom. Usher it in, not through suffering. Usher it in through some other way. It's the same topics. Same things happening here, same characters. Jesus and Satan are going toe-to-toe on the eve of redemption. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Verse 42. He went away a second time and prayed. Notice he's counting them. My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done. Again, Jesus is victorious. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time. He's counting them. He wants you to see the parallel. Saying the same thing. Notice he's like, I don't have time. My scroll's running out. He just said the same stuff. Moving on. Verse 45, then he returned to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? And there may be a spiritual reality to that question as much as there is a physical one. Because what is this? What is their sleeping and resting based on what they just said in verse 35? They still don't have their eyes open to the way in which Jesus is supposed to be. Even if the bloody revolution comes, Peter says, I will fight for you to the death. And all the other disciples said, same here. And Jesus says, are you still sleeping? Look, at this hour, or look, the hour is near, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, that line is not in there just for fluff. He's emphasizing the magnitude of this betrayal, arrived. With him was a large crowd, armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now notice what they are armed with. Swords and clubs. Swords, the word for swords, will be used 5 times in the Gospel of Matthew. All of them predominantly concentrated here in chapter 26. First time it is used, can you think, not in chapter 26, not even in the 20s. When was the first time the word sword was used in the Gospel of Matthew? What? Yes, chapter 10, verse 34. Jesus looks at him and he says, For I've not come to bring peace, but I've come with a sword to divide the world. And what was the sword in that context? The message. The message, right? Didn't we talked about that in chapter 10. What he was bringing as a sword that divides is the message. Because he doesn't have room to hold the actual sword because he's carrying a cross. Very first time it is used, Jesus is emphasizing the message of the kingdom, which is that we win through suffering. Second time it is used is right here in verse 47, where they bring swords, the large crowd, to come after Jesus and his small little group of disciples. Next time it's used in chapter 26, verse 51, which will say, with that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out and struck the high priest. In other words, one of Jesus' companions uses the sword to fight violence and to progress their kingdom. The next time the word is used in verse 52, where Jesus rebukes his disciples and says, put your sword away. The final time it is used in chapter 26, verse 55, when Jesus looks at the crowd and listen to what he says. Jesus says, am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Others looks at me and says, you think you got to fight me with violence? Have I ever been violent? The word swords is structuring this whole scene so that we can see the two groups coming together, each of them possessing swords. One of them chooses to use them one way, one of them uses them a different way. Let's keep going. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Friend," do what you come for. Every time in the Gospel of Matthew, the word friend is used, is always used in a derogatory way. Why does your teacher, your master, why does he eat and act as if he is friends with sinners? Remember that? Or whenever the wicked servants are there in the parable, the master looks at him and he says, "Friend," the ones that are objecting because they didn't get paid the same amount of wages, "Friend, didn't I pay you exactly what we agreed on?" It's always used in a derogatory manner. And Jesus says, "Friend, do what you come for." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Notice it doesn't say the name of the person. Why? Because based on verse 35, it could have been any disciple. Because all of them said we would do this. So it's inconsequential who it was that did it, although we do know it's Peter. It's inconsequential because all of them would have done it. All of them were willing to fight a bloody revolution. Put your sword back in its place. Now this is very important, this next phrase. Because Jesus is going to clearly demarcate a distinguishing factor of his kingdom. You come at me with swords and clubs because you perpetuate your kingdom through violence. Matthew chapter 11, verse 12. For the kingdom has been advanced until now through violence by the hands of violent men who have laid hold of it. Versus his kingdom, which he says, that's not the way we roll. That's not what we do. Put your sword back in its place. Matter of fact, Tertullian, you got to respect early church fathers, says in the treatise on idolatry in 19, he says, in disarming Peter, the Lord disarmed every Christian. Then Jesus says this, "For all who draw the sword will die by the sword." What he says this, violence breeds violence. That's all it does. Here's the reality. If I'm the biggest bully on the block and I beat people into submission to me, are they all going to be like, "Oh, shucks, you swell guy. I guess because you beat us enough, we'll just gladly follow you." What are they looking for? An opportunity to knock off the bully. Right? I mean, isn't that true? That's what they're looking for. If I get the biggest stick, then you're in trouble. And Jesus says, I don't want to just breed more violence. He says, I want to destroy the whole system. And the way I'm going to do it is not by getting the biggest stick, but it's by hanging on your cross. That's how I'm going to do it. Revelation chapter 12, verses 10 through 12 says, how do we conquer the dragon? How do we destroy Satan? Through the blood of the slain lamb. And through the testimony of the saints that would not shrink from death. That's how we win. Jesus says, put back your sword in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father and He will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? Jesus says, I already have the biggest stick. Isn't that what He says? This isn't a fight for who has the biggest power, because I already have all the power. But I am completely reliant on God, that if God says, go and die, then I trust that that's how we win. It doesn't have to make sense to me. It doesn't have to make sense. The question is not, does this logically follow? The question is, will you obey? Period. And Jesus looks at him and he says, if I wanted to, I could have called down thousands of angels. Notice he doesn't say that. That's what he means. Technically, he could have said, if you have only, I could have called down 72,000 angels. What does he say instead? 12, that number's significant. Legions, that word's significant. That's politically explosive. If I want to, I could have called down a complete number of legions, armies, political war. I could have fought with your tools and won. That's what he's saying. If I wanted to. And then he goes on and says this, but how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way? He says, but bottom line is, God's will is more important than what I want. It's always been more important. At that time, Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion?" The word he uses for rebellion there is laestes. We've already looked at this word before. It is the word for political revolutionaries, insurrectionists. People, zealots that come and they fight with violence to perpetuate their kingdom of violence. He says, is that what I'm leading? Is my kingdom characterized by that use of the sword? By that particular sword? That you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? That's what you think I'm doing. And what's interesting is right there in verse 55 is where he first speaks to the crowd. Who has he been talking to up until that point of the rebuke? His disciples. He's like, you guys are missing it. Are you this dull? Are you still asleep that you think that you're supposed to bring a sword and start fighting them? And then he looks at the crowd and he says, do you think this is what we're about? Because it's not. And he goes on and he says, every day I sat in the temple courts teaching and you didn't arrest me. In other words, he's saying, why didn't you arrest me then if I'm such a violent political revolutionary? I mean, I was right there in the courts. You could have done it there. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. The word for deserted is actually very interesting. It's a phiomi. And Jesus uses that word in the Lord's Supper. And we translate it there as forgiveness. Because the idea is that it's divorced, deserted, sent away, let go. That Jesus says, what you do against me, your sins, will be a phiomi. They will be sent away, divorced from you, if you submit yourself to me. And what is interesting is that in this context, the disciples phiomi Jesus. But they desert him. They divorce themselves from him. What you need to picture is soldiers at a battle. And all of a sudden, whenever the battle starts to come in, they turn around and they divorce themselves from the war and they walk away. And that's what happens right here because the disciples refuse to see the kingdom through Jesus' lens. They want a bloody revolution. And whenever they start it, he stopped it. And then he looked at him and he said, if I wanted a bloody revolution, I wouldn't rely on the 11 of you know, ruffians. I'd call down 72,000 angels. That's not the way I fight. How do I fight? I'm going to hang on a cross. Why? Because this is the cup God wants me to drink. Those who arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas. We've already seen him once. The high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. Obviously, Peter is probably following out of concern, but more out of confusion, probably. I don't understand what's going on. Why didn't he rise up? He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward. Why the number two? Exactly. Because in a Jewish court of law, you need to have 2 to 3 witnesses for any testimony against someone to be valid. Finally, two came forward and declared, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Did Jesus ever say that in the Gospel of Matthew? No. He never says that phrase in the Gospel of Matthew. He does say it in John chapter 2, verse 19. But Jesus does predict the destruction of the temple, but he never says he will build it in 3 days in the Gospel of Matthew. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. Again, in their kingdom, if somebody accuses you falsely, you fight for your honor. You do whatever it takes, even killing someone. I find it very interesting that they're looking for a way to kill an innocent man, but they still want to follow the letter of the law, so they have to have 2 to 3 witnesses. They're still playing the game of their kingdom. They're still playing out the political program of their kingdom. But what Jesus says by being silent is, I refuse to play your game. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say. But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. First coming or second coming? What? How do I know? Coming on the clouds, Son of Man. Daniel. chapter 7. Not more clear than that. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" Well, the only thing that they know how to think is the political program of their kingdom. "He is worthy of death." Violence is what they think. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?" In this whole event, the two kingdoms are more than ever put on display. This is who they are. This is how they fight. This is how they win. This is how they go. And the reason why Matthew does this is because he looks at his audience and he says, which kingdom are you fighting for? Because how you fight also tells me who you're fighting for. Love you guys. See you in the morning. We have a test.